grunted deprecatingly, but I thought he was pleased nonetheless. "Only a raid, Sassenach. I've been doing that since I was 14. It's only in fun, you see. It's different when you're up against someone who really means to kill you."
"Fun?" I said, a little faintly.
"Yes, quite."
His arms tightened around me, and one of the stroking hands dipped lower, beginning to inch my skirt upward. Clearly, the thrill of the fight was being transmuted into a different kind of excitement.
"Jimmy, not here," I said, squirming away and pushing my skirt down again. "Are you tired, Sassenach?"
he asked with concern. "Dinna worry. It won't take long." Now both hands were at it, rucking the heavy fabric up in front.
"No,"
I replied, all too mindful of the 20 men lying a few feet away.
"I'm not tired, it's just..."
I gasped as his groping hand found its way between my legs.
"Lord," he said softly, "it's slippery as waterweed." "Jimmy, there are 20 men sleeping right next to us," I shouted in a whisper.
"They will not be sleeping long if you keep talking."
He rolled on top of me, pinning me to the rock. His knee wedged between my thighs and began to work gently back and forth. Despite myself, my legs were beginning to loosen. 27 years of propriety were no match for several hundred thousand years of instinct. While my mind might object to being taken on a bare rock next to several sleeping soldiers, my body plainly considered itself the spoils of war and was eager to complete the formalities of surrender. He kissed me, long and deep, his tongue sweet and restless in my mouth.
"Jimmy,"
I panted. He pushed his kilt out of the way and pressed my hand against him.
"Bloody Christ," I said,
impressed despite myself. My sense of propriety slipped another notch.
"Fighting gives you a terrible cockstand after."
"You want me, do you know?"
he said, pulling back a little to look at me. It seemed pointless to deny it, what with all the evidence to hand. He was hard as a brass rod against my bared thigh.
Yes, but..."
He took a firm grip on my shoulders with both hands.
"Be quiet, Sassenach," he said with authority. "It isna going to take very long."
It didn't. I began to climax with the first powerful thrust in long, racking spasms. I dug my fingers hard into his back and held on, biting the fabric of his shirt to muffle any sounds. In less than a dozen strokes, I felt his testicles contract tight against his body and the warm flood of his own release. He lowered himself slowly to the side and lay trembling. The blood was still beating heavily in my ears, echoing the fading pulse between my legs. Jamie's hand lay on my breast, limp and heavy. Turning my head, I could see the dim figure of the sentry leaning against a rock on the far side of the fire. He had his back tactfully turned. I was mildly shocked to realize I wasn't even embarrassed. I wondered rather dimly whether I would be in the morning, and then wondered no more. In the morning, everyone behaved as usual, if moving a little more stiffly from the effects of fighting and sleeping on rocks. Everyone was in a cheerful humour, even those with minor wounds. The general humour was improved still further when Dougal announced that we would travel only as far as the clump of woods we could see from the edge of our rocky platform. There we could water and graze the horses and rest a bit ourselves. I wondered whether this change of plan would affect Jamie's rendezvous with the mysterious Horrocks, but he seemed undisturbed at the announcement. The day was overcast but not drizzling, and the air was warm. Once the new camp was made, the horses taken care of, and the wounded all rechecked, everyone was left to his own devices, to sleep in the grass, to hunt or fish, or merely to stretch legs after several days in the saddle. I was sitting under a tree talking to Jamie and Ned Gowan when one of the men-at-arms came up and flipped something into Jamie's lap. It was the dirk with the moonstone hilt.
"Yours, lad?" he asked. "'Phoned it in the rocks this morning.' "'I must have dropped it in all the excitement,' I said. "'Just as well. I've no idea what to do with it. "'I'd likely have stabbed myself if I'd tried to use it.' Ned eyed Jamie censoriously over his half-spectacles. "'You gave her a knife and didn't teach her to use it?' "'There wasn't a time under the circumstances,' Jamie defended himself. "'But Ned's right, Sasnach. You should learn how to handle arms. There's no telling what may happen on the road, as you saw last night.'
So I was marched out into the centre of a clearing, and the lessons began. Seeing the activity, several of the Mackenzie men came by to investigate and stayed to offer advice. In no time, I had half a dozen instructors all arguing the fine points of technique. After a good deal of amiable discussion, they agreed that Rupert was likely the best among them at Dirk's, and he took over the lesson. He found a reasonably flat spot, free of rocks and pine cones, in which to demonstrate the art of dagger wielding. "Look, lass," he said. He held the dagger balanced on his middle finger, resting an inch or so below the haft. "The balance point, that's where you want to hold it, so it fits comfortable in your hand." I tried it with my dagger. When I had it comfortably fitted, he showed me the difference between an overhand strike and an underhanded stab. "Generally, you want to use the underhand. Overhand is only good when you're coming down on someone with a considerable force from above." He eyed me speculatively, then shook his head. "Nay, you're tall for a woman, but even if you could reach as high as the neck, you wouldn't have the force to penetrate unless he's sitting. Best stick to underhand." He pulled up his shirt, revealing a substantial furry paunch, already glistening with sweat. "Now, here," he said, pointing to the centre, just under the breastbone, "is the spot to aim for if you're killing face to face. Aim straight up and in as hard as you can. That'll go into the heart, and it kills within a minute or two. The only problem is to avoid the breastbone. It goes down lower than you think, and if you get your knife stuck in that soft bit on the tip, it will hardly harm your victim at all, but you'll be without a knife, and he'll hear you. Merta, ye here, skinny back. Come here and we'll show the lass how to stick from the back." Spinning a reluctant Merta around, he yanked up the grubby shirt to show a knobbly spine and prominent ribs. He poked a blunt forefinger under the lower rib on the right, making Murta squeak in surprise. "This is the spot in back, either side. See, we all the ribs and such. 'Tis very difficult to hit anything vital when you stab in the back. If you can slip the knife between the ribs, that's one thing. But that's harder to do than you might think. But here, under the last rib, you stab upward into the kidney. Get him straight up and he'll drop like a stone." Rupert then set me to try stabbing in various positions and postures. As he grew winded, all the men took it in turns to act as victim, obviously finding my efforts hilarious. They obligingly lay on the grass or turned their backs so I could ambush them, or leapt at me from behind, or pretended to choke me so I could try to stab them in the belly. The spectators urged me on with cries of encouragement, and Rupert instructed me firmly not to pull back at the last moment. "Thrust as though you meant it, lass," he said. "You canna pull back if it's in earnest. And if any of these laggards cannot get themselves out of the way in time, they deserve what they get." I was timid and extremely clumsy at first, but Rupert was a good teacher, very patient and good about demonstrating moves over and over. He rolled his eyes in mock lewdness when he moved behind me and put his arm about my waist. But he was quite businesslike about taking hold of my wrist to show me the way of ripping an enemy across the eyes. Dougal sat under a tree, minding his wounded arm and making sardonic comments on the training as it progressed. It was he, though, who suggested the dummy.
"Gear something she can sink her dirk into," he said, when I had begun to show some facility at lunging and jabbing. "It's a shock the first time."
"So it is," Jamie agreed. "Rest a bit, Sasnach, while I manage something."
He went off to the wagons with two of the men-at-arms, and I could see them standing heads together, gesticulating and pulling bits of things from the wagon bed. Thoroughly winded, I collapsed under the tree next to Dougal. He nodded, a slight smile on his face. Like most of the men, he hadn't bothered to shave while travelling, and a heavy growth of dark brown beard framed his mouth, accentuating the full lower lip.
"Who is it, then?" he asked, not meaning my skill with small arms.
"Well enough," I answered warily, not meaning knives either. Dougal's gaze flicked toward Jamie, busy with something by the wagons.
"Marriage seems to suit the lad," he observed.
"Rather healthy for him."
"Under the circumstances," I agreed somewhat coldly.
His lips curved at my tone.
"And you, lass, as well. A good arrangement for everyone, it seems."
"Particularly for you and your brother. And speaking of him, just what do you think Colum's going to say when he hears about it?" The smile widened.
"Colum? Oh, well, I should think he'd be only too pleased to welcome such a niece to the family."
The dummy was ready, and I went back into training. It proved to be a large bag of wool, about the size of a man's torso, with a piece of tanned bull's hide wrapped around it, secured with rope. This I was to practice stabbing. First, as it was tied to a tree at man height, later, as it was thrown or rolled past me. What Jamie hadn't mentioned was that they had inserted several flat pieces of wood between the wool sack and the hide to simulate bones, as he later explained. The first few stabs were uneventful, though it took several tries to get through the bull hide. It was tougher than it looked. So is the skin on a man's belly, I was informed. On the next try, I tried a direct overhand strike and hit one of the wood pieces. I thought for a moment that my arm had suddenly fallen off. The shock of impact reverberated all the way to my shoulder, and the dirt dropped from my nerveless fingers. Everything below the elbow was numb, but an ominous tingling warned me that it wouldn't be for long.
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said.
I stood gripping my elbow and listening to the general hilarity. Finally, Jamie took me by the shoulder and massaged some feeling back into the arm, pressing the tendon at the base of the elbow and digging his thumb into the hollow at the base of my wrist.
"All right," I said through my teeth, gingerly flexing my tingling right hand. "What do you do when you hit a bone and lose your knife? Is there a standard operating procedure for that?"
"Oh, aye,"
said Rupert, grinning. "Draw your pistol with the left hand and shoot the bastard dead." This resulted in more howls of laughter, which I ignored.
"All right," I said, more or less calmly. I gestured at the long, claw-handled pistol Jamie wore on his left hip.
"Are you going to show me how to load and shoot that, then?"
"I am not."
He was firm. I bristled a bit at this.
"Why not?"
"Because you're a woman, Sassenach."
I felt my face flush at this.
"Oh," I said sarcastically, "you think women aren't bright enough to understand the workings of a gun?"
He looked levelly at me, mouth twisting a bit as he thought over various replies.
"Never mind to let you try it," he said at last. "It would serve you right."
Rupert clicked his tongue in annoyance at us both.
"Dinna be daft, Jamie. As for you, lass," turning to me, "it's not that women are stupid, though sure enough some of them are. It's that they are small."
"Eh?" I gaped stupidly at him for a moment. Jamie snorted and drew the pistol from its loop. Seen up close, it was enormous. A full 18 inches of silvered weapon measured from stock to muzzle.
"Look," he said, holding it in front of me. "You hold it here. You brace it on your forearm, and you sight along here. And when you pull the trigger, it kicks like a mule. I'm near a foot taller than you, 4 stone heavier, and I know what I'm doing. It gives me a wicked bruise when I fire it. It might knock you flat on your back, if it didn't catch you in the face."
He twirled the pistol and slid it back into its loop.
"I'll let you see for yourself," he said, raising one eyebrow. "But I like you better with all of your teeth. You've a nice smile, Sassenach, even if you are a bit feisty."
Slightly chastened by this episode, I accepted without argument the men's judgment that even the lighter small sword was too heavy for me to wield efficiently. The tiny skiandu, the sock dagger, was deemed acceptable, and I was provided with one of those, a wicked-looking, needle-sharp piece of black iron, about 3 inches long, with a short hilt. I practiced drawing it from its place of concealment over and over while the men watched critically, until I could sweep up my skirt, grab the knife from its place, and come up in the proper crouch, all in one smooth move, ending with the knife held underhand, ready to slash across an adversary's throat. Finally, I was passed as a novice knife-wielder, and allowed to sit down to dinner, amid general congratulations, with one exception. Murta shook his head dubiously. "I still say the only good weapon for a woman is poison."
"Perhaps," replied Dougal, "but it has its deficiencies in face-to-face combat."
Chapter 19. The Water Horse. We camped the next night on the banks above Loch Ness. It gave me an odd feeling to see the place again. So little had changed.
Or would change, I should say.
The larches and alders were a deeper green, because it was now midsummer, not late spring. The flowers had changed from the fragile pinks and whites of May blossom and violets to the warmer golds and yellows of gorse and broom. The sky above was a deeper blue, but the surface of the loch was the same, a flat blue-black that caught the reflections from the bank above and held them trapped, colours muted under smoked glass. There were even a few sailboats visible, far up the loch, though when one drew near, I saw it was a coracle, a rough half-shell of tanned leather on a frame, not the sleek wooden shape I was used to. The same pungent scent that pervades all watercourses was there, a sharp mix of tangy greenness and rotted leaf, fresh water, dead fish, and warm mud. Above all, there was that same feeling of lurking strangeness about the place. The men, as well as the horses, seemed to feel it, and the air of the camp was subdued. Having found a comfortable place for my own bedroll and Jamie's, I wandered down to the edge of the loch to wash my face and hands before supper. The bank sloped sharply down until it broke in a jumble of large rock slabs that formed a sort of irregular jetty. It was very peaceful under the bank, out of sight and sound of the camp, and I sat down beneath a tree to enjoy a moment's privacy. Since my hasty marriage to Jamie, I was no longer followed every moment. That much had been accomplished. I was idly plucking the clusters of winged seeds from a low-hanging branch and tossing them out into the loch, when I noticed the tiny waves against the rocks growing stronger, as though pushed by an oncoming wind. A great flat head broke the surface, not 10 feet away. I could see the water purling away from keeled scales that ran in a crest down the sinuous neck. The water was agitated for some considerable distance, and I caught a glimpse here and there of dark and massive movement beneath the surface of the loch, though the head itself stayed relatively still. I stood quite still myself. Oddly enough, I wasn't really afraid. I felt some faint kinship with it, a creature further from its own time than I. The flat eyes, old as its ancient Eocene seas, eyes grown dim in the murky depths of its shrunken refuge. And there was a sense of familiarity mingled with its unreality. The sleek skin was a smooth, deep blue, with a vivid slash of green shining with brilliant iridescence beneath the jaw. And the strange, pupil-less eyes were a deep and glowing amber, so very beautiful. And so very different from the smaller, mud-coloured replica I remembered, adorning the fifth-floor diorama in the British Museum. But the shape was unmistakable. The colours of living things begin to fade with the last breath, and the soft, springy skin and supple muscle rot within weeks. But the bones sometimes remain, faithful echoes of the shape, to bear some last faint witness to the glory of what was. Valve nostrils opened suddenly with a startling hiss of breath. A moment of suspended motion, and the creature sank again, a churning roil of waters the only testimony to its passage. I had risen to my feet when it appeared, and unconsciously I must have moved closer in order to watch it, for I found myself standing on one of the rock slabs that jutted out into the water, watching the dying waves fall back into the smoothness of the loch. I stood there for a moment, looking out across the fathomless loch. "Goodbye," I said at last to the empty water. I shook myself and turned back to the bank. A man was standing at the top of the slope. I was startled at first, then recognized him as one of the drovers from our party. His name was Peter, I recalled, and the bucket in his hand gave the reason for his presence. I was about to ask him whether he had seen the beast, but the expression on his face as I drew near was more than sufficient answer. His face was paler than the daisies at his feet, and tiny droplets of sweat trickled down into his beard. His eyes showed white all around like those of a terrified horse, and his hand shook so that the bucket bumped against his leg. "It's all right," I said as I came up to him. "It's gone." Instead of finding this statement reassuring, it seemed occasion for fresh alarm. He dropped the bucket, fell to his knees before me, and crossed himself. "Have mercy, lady," he stammered. To my extreme embarrassment, he then flung himself flat on his face and clutched at the hem of my dress. "Don't be ridiculous," I said with some asperity. "Get up!" I prodded him gently with my toe, but he only quivered and stayed pressed to the ground like a flattened fungus. "Get up!" I repeated. "Stupid man, it's only a..." I paused, trying to think. Telling him its Latin name was unlikely to help. "It's only a wee monster," I said at last, and grabbing his hand, tugged him to his feet. I had to fill the bucket, as he would, not unreasonably, not go near the water's edge again. He followed me back to the camp, keeping a careful distance, and scuttled off at once to tend to his mules, casting apprehensive glances over his shoulder at me as he went. As he seemed undisposed to mention the creature to anyone else, I thought perhaps I should keep quiet as well. While Dougal, Jamie, and Ned were educated men, the rest were largely illiterate Highlanders from the remote crags and glens of the Mackenzie lands. They were courageous fighters and dauntless warriors, but they were also as superstitious as any primitive tribesman from Africa or the Middle East. So I ate my supper quietly and went to bed, conscious all the time of the wary gaze of the drover, Peter. Chapter 20. Deserted Glades. 2 days after the raid, we turned again to the north. We were drawing closer to the rendezvous with Horrocks, and Jamie seemed abstracted from time to time, perhaps considering what importance the English deserter's news might have. I hadn't seen Hugh Monroe again, but I had wakened in darkness the night before to find Jamie gone from the blanket beside me. I tried to stay awake, waiting for him to return, but fell asleep as the moon began to sink. In the morning he was sound asleep beside me, and on my blanket rested a small parcel done up in a sheet of thin paper, fastened with a tail feather of a woodpecker thrust through the sheet. Unfolding it carefully, I found a large chunk of rough amber. One face of the chunk had been smoothed off and polished, and in this window could be seen the delicate dark form of a tiny dragonfly suspended in eternal flight. I smoothed out the wrapping. A message was incised on the grimy white surface, written in small and surprisingly elegant lettering. "What does it say?" I asked Jamie, squinting at the odd letters and marks. "I think it's in Gaelic." He raised up on one elbow, squinting at the paper. "Not Gaelic. Latin. Monroe was a schoolmaster once, before the Turks took him. It's a bit from Catullus," he said. "Da mia basia mille, diende centum. Deen mille, altera, deen secunda centum." A faint blush pinkened his earlobes as he translated. "Then let amorous kisses dwell on our lips. Begin and tell 1,000 and 100 score. 100
and 1,000 more.
"Well, that's a bit more high class than your usual fortune cookie," I observed, amused.
"What?"
Jamie looked startled. "Never mind," I said hastily. "Did Monroe find Horrocks for you?"
"Oh, aye. It's arranged. I'll meet him in a small place I know in the hills, a mile or two above Lag Cruim. In 4 days' time, if nothing goes wrong meanwhile."
The mention of things going wrong made me a bit nervous. "Do you think it's safe? I mean, do you trust Horrocks?"
He sat up, rubbing the remnants of sleep from his eyes and blinking. "An English deserter? God, no. I imagine he'd sell me to Randall as soon as he'd spit. Except that he cannot very well go to the English himself. They hang deserters. No, I dinna trust him. That's why I came with Dougal on this journey instead of seeking out Horrocks alone. If the man's up to anything, at least I'll have company."
"Oh." I wasn't sure that Dougal's presence was all that reassuring, given the apparent state of affairs between Jamie and his two scheming uncles.
"Well, if you think so," I said doubtfully, "I don't suppose Dougal would take the opportunity to shoot you, at least."
"He did shoot me," Jamie said cheerfully, buttoning his shirt. "You should know. You dressed the wound."
I dropped the comb I had been using.
"Dougal? I thought the English shot you."
"Well, the English shot at me," he corrected. "And I shouldn't say it was Dougal shot me. In fact, it was probably Rupert. He's the best marksman among Dougal's men. No, when we were running from the English, I realised we were near the edge of the Fraser Lands, and I thought I'd take my chances there. So I spurred up and cut to the left, around Dougal and the rest. There was a good deal of shooting going on, mind you, but the ball that hit me came from behind. Dougal, Rupert and Murtagh were in back of me then, and the English were all in front. In fact, when I fell off the horse, I rolled down the hill and ended almost in their laps."
He bent over the bucket of water I had brought, splashing cold handfuls over his face. He shook his head to clear his eyes, then blinked at me, grinning, glistening drops clinging to his thick lashes and brows.
"Come to that, Dougal had a sore fight to get me back. I was lying on the ground, not fit for much, and he was standing over me, pulling on my belt with one hand to get me up, and his sword in the other, going hand to hand with a dragoon who thought he had a certain cure for my ills. Dougal killed the man and got me on his own horse."
He shook his head. "Everything was a bit dim to me then. All I could think of was how hard it must be on the horse, trying to make it up a hill like that with 400 pounds on his back." I sat back, a little stunned.
"But if he'd wanted to, Dougal could have killed you then."
Jamie shook his head, taking out the straight razor he had borrowed from Dougal. He moved the bucket slightly, so the surface formed a reflecting pool, and pulling his face into the tortuous grimace men use when they shave, began to scrape his cheeks.
"No, not in front of the men. Besides, Dougal and Colum didn't necessarily want me dead. Especially not Dougal."
"But..." My head was beginning to whirl again, as it seemed to do whenever I encountered the complexities of Scottish family life. Jamie's words were a little muffled as he stuck out his chin, tilting his head to reach the bit of stubble beneath his jaw.
"It's Lallybroch," he explained, feeling with his free hand for stray whiskers. "Besides being a rich bit of ground, the estate sits at the head of a mountain pass, do you see? The only good pass into the Highlands for 10 miles in either direction. Come to another rising, it would be a valuable bit of land to control. And if I were to die before wedding, chances are the land would go back to the Frasers."
He grinned, stroking his neck.
"No, I'm a pretty problem to the brothers Mackenzie. On the one hand, if I'm a threat to young Hamish's chieftainship, they want me safely dead. On the other, if I'm not, they want me and my property securely on their side if it comes to war, not we the Frasers.
That's why they're willing to help me wi' Horrock, Sissy. I canna do that much wi' Lallybroch while I'm outlawed, even though the land's still mine.
I rolled up the blankets, shaking my head in bewilderment over the intricate and dangerous circumstances through which Jamie seemed to move so nonchalantly. And it struck me suddenly that not only Jamie was involved now. I looked up. "You said that if you died before wedding, the land would go back to the Frasers," I said. "But you're married now. So who..."
"That's right," he said,
nodding at me with a lopsided grin. The morning sun lit his hair with flames of gold and copper.
"If I'm killed now, Sassenach, Lallybroch is yours."
It was a beautiful sunny morning, once the mist had risen. Birds were busy in the heather, and the road was wide here for a change, and softly dusty under the horses' hooves. Jamie rode up close beside me as we crested a small hill. He nodded to the right.
"See that wee glade down below there?"
"Yes." It was a small green patchwork of pines, oaks and aspens, set back some distance from the road.
"There's a spring with a pool there under the trees, and smooth grass. A very bonny place."
I looked over at him quizzically.
"A little early for lunch, isn't it?"
"That's not precisely what I had in mind."
Jamie, I had found out by accident a few days previously, had never mastered the art of winking one eye. Instead, he blinked solemnly like a large red owl.
"And just what did you have in mind?" I inquired. My suspicious look met an innocent, childlike gaze of blue.
"I was just wondering what you'd look like. On the grass, under the trees, by the water, with your skirts up around your ears."
"Ah," I said,
"I'll tell Dougal we're going to fetch water."
He spurred up ahead, returning in a moment with the water bottles from the other horses. I heard Rupert shout something after us in Gaelic as we rode down the hill, but couldn't make out the words. I reached the glade first. Sliding down, I relaxed on the grass and shut my eyes against the glare of the sun. Jamie reined up beside me a moment later and swung down from the saddle. He slapped the horse and sent it away, reins dangling, to graze with mine, before dropping to his knees on the grass. I reached up and pulled him down to me. It was a warm day, redolent with grass and flower scents. Jamie himself smelled like a fresh-plucked grass blade, sharp and sweet.
"We'll have to be quick," I said. "They'll be wondering why it's taking so long to get water."
"They won't wonder," he said, undoing my laces with a practiced ease. "They know."
"What do you mean?"
"Did you not hear what Rupert said as we left?"
"I heard him, but I couldn't tell what he said."
My Gaelic was improving to the point that I could understand the more common words, but conversation was still far beyond me.
"Good. It wasn't a fit for your ears."
Having freed my breasts, he buried his face in them, sucking and biting gently until I could stand it no more, and slid down beneath him, tucking my skirts up out of the way. Feeling absurdly self-conscious after that fierce and primitive encounter on the rock, I had been shy about letting him make love to me near the camp, and the woods were too thick to safely move very far from the campsite. Both of us were feeling the mild and pleasant strain of abstinence, and now, safely removed from curious eyes and ears, we came together with an impact that made my lips and fingers tingle with a rush of blood. We were both nearing the end when Jamie froze abruptly. Opening my eyes, I saw his face dark against the sun, wearing a perfectly indescribable expression. There was something black pressed against his head. My eyes, at last adjusting to the glare, I saw it was a musket barrel.
"Get up, you rutting bastard."
The barrel moved sharply, jarring against Jamie's temple. Very slowly, he rose to his feet. A drop of blood began to well from the graze, dark against his white face. There were two of them, red-coat deserters from the look of their ragtag remnants of uniform. Both were armed with muskets and pistols, and looked very much amused by what chance had delivered into their hands. Jamie stood with his hands raised, the barrel of a musket pressed against his chest, face carefully expressionless.
"You might have let him finish, Harry," said one of the men.
He grinned broadly with a fine display of rotting teeth.
"Stopping in the middle like that's bad for a man's health."
His fellow prodded Jamie in the chest with the musket.
"His health's no concern of mine, and it won't be any concern to him for much longer. I've a mind to take a piece of that."
He nodded briefly in my direction.
"And I don't care to come second to any man, let alone a Scottish orson like this."
Rotten Teeth laughed.
"I bain't so bloody particular. Kill him then and get on with it."
Harry, a short, stout man with a squint, considered a moment, eyeing me speculatively. I still sat on the ground, knees drawn up and skirts pressed firmly around my ankles. I had made some effort to close my bodice, but a good deal was still exposed. Finally, the short man laughed and beckoned to his companion.
"Now, let him watch. Come over here, Arnold, and hold your musket on him."
Arnold obeyed, still grinning widely. Harry set his musket down on the ground and dropped his pistol belt beside it in preparation. Pressing my skirts down, I became aware of a hard object in the right-hand pocket. The dagger Jamie had given me. Could I bring myself to use it? Yes, I decided, looking at Harry's pimpled, leering face. I definitely could. I would have to wait till the last possible second, though, and I had my doubts as to whether Jamie could control himself that long. I could see the urge to kill marked strong on his features. Soon, consideration of the consequences would no longer be enough to hold him back. I didn't dare let too much show on my face, but narrowed my eyes and glared at him as hard as I could, willing him not to move. The cord stood out in his neck, and his face was suffused with dark blood, but I saw an infinitesimal nod in acknowledgement of my message. I struggled as Harry pressed me to the ground and tried to pull up my skirts, more in order to get my hand on the dagger hilt than in actual resistance. He slapped me hard across the face, ordering me to be still. My cheek burned, and my eyes watered, but the dagger was now in my hand, concealed under the folds of the skirt. I lay back, breathing heavily. I concentrated on my objective, trying to erase everything else from my mind. It would have to be in the back. The quarters were too close to try for the throat. The filthy fingers were digging into my thighs now, wrenching them apart. In my mind, I could see Rupert's blunt finger stabbing at Murtagh's ribs and hear his voice, "Here, lass, up under the lowest ribs, close to the backbone. Stab hard, upward into the kidney, and he'll drop like a stone." It was almost time. Harry's foul breath was disgustingly warm on my face, and he was fumbling between my bared legs, intent on his goal.
"Take a good look, laddie, Buck, and see how it's done," he panted. "I'll have your slut moaning for more before."
I whipped my left arm around his neck to hold him close. Holding the knife hand high, I plunged it in as hard as I could. The shock of impact reverberated up my arm, and I nearly lost my hold on the dagger. Harry yelped and squirmed, twisting to get away. Unable to see, I had aimed too high, and the knife had skittered off a rib. I couldn't let go now. Luckily, my legs were free of the entangling skirts. I wrapped them tightly around Harry's sweating hips, holding him down for the precious seconds I needed for another try. I stabbed again with a desperate strength, and this time found the spot. Rupert had been right. Harry bucked in a hideous parody of the act of love, then collapsed without a sound in a limp heap on top of me, blood jetting in diminishing spurts from the wound in his back. Arnold's attention had been distracted for an instant by the spectacle on the ground, and an instant was more than long enough for the maddened Scotsman he held at bay.
By the time I'd gathered my wits sufficiently to wriggle out from under the defunct Harry, Arnold had joined his companion in death, throat neatly cut from ear to ear by the skean-do that Jamie carried in his stocking. Jamie knelt beside me, pulling me out from under the corpse. We were both shaking with nerves and shock, and we clung together without speaking for minutes. Still without speaking, he picked me up and carried me away from the two bodies to a grassy space behind a screen of aspen. He lowered me to the ground and sat down awkwardly beside me, collapsing as though his knees had suddenly given way. I felt a chilly isolation, as though the winter wind blew through my bones, and reached for him. He raised his head from his knees, face haggard, and stared at me as though he had never seen me before. When I put my hands on his shoulders, he pulled me hard against his chest with a sound midway between a groan and a sob. We took each other then, in a savage, urgent silence, thrusting fiercely and finishing within moments, driven by a compulsion I didn't understand, but knew we must obey, or be lost to each other forever. It wasn't an act of love, but one of necessity, as though we knew that, left alone, neither of us could stand. Our only strength lay in fusion, drowning the memories of death and near rape in the flooding of the senses. We clung together on the grass then, dishevelled, blood-stained, and shivering in the sunshine. Jamie muttered something, his voice so low that I caught only the word, "Sorry." "Not your fault," I muttered, stroking his hair. "It's all right. We're both all right." I felt dreamlike, as though nothing whatever was real around me, and I dimly recognized the symptoms of delayed shock.
"Not that," he said. "Not that. It was my fault. So foolish to come here without taking proper heed. And to let you be... I didn't mean that, though. I meant... I'm sorry for using you as I did just now. To take you like that so soon after... Like some sort of animal. I'm sorry, Claire. I don't know what... I couldn't help it, but... Lord, you're so cold, Madunya. Your hands are ice. Come then, let me warm you."
"Shock, too," I thought fuzzily. "Funny how it takes some people in talk. Others just shake quietly, like me." I pressed his mouth against my shoulder to quiet him. "It's all right," I said over and over. "It's all right."
Suddenly a shadow fell across us, making us both jump. Dougal stood glowering down at us, arms folded. He courteously averted his eyes while I hastily did up my laces, frowning instead at Jamie. "Now look here, lad. Taking your pleasure with your wife is all very well, but when it comes to leaving us all waiting for more than an hour, and being so taken up with each other that you dinna even hear me coming, that kind of behaviour will get you in trouble one day, laddie. Why, someone could come up behind you and clap a pistol to your head before you knew..."
He stopped in his tirade to stare incredulously at me, rolling on the grass in hysterics. Jamie, red as a beetroot, led Dougal to the other side of the aspen screen, explaining in a subdued voice. I continued to whoop and giggle uncontrollably, finally stuffing a handkerchief in my mouth to muffle the noise. The sudden release of emotions, coupled with Dougal's words, had evoked a picture of Jamie's face caught in the act, as it were, that I found totally hilarious in my unhinged state. I laughed and moaned until my sides ached. Finally, I sat up, wiping my eyes on my kerchief, to see Dougal and Jamie standing over me, wearing identical expressions of disapproval. Jamie hoisted me to my feet and led me, still hiccuping and snorting occasionally, to where the rest of the men were waiting with the horses. Except for a lingering tendency to laugh hysterically over nothing, I seemed to suffer no ill effects from our encounter with the deserters, though I became very cautious about leaving the campsite. Dougal assured me that bandits were not, in fact, that common on the Highland roads,
only because there weren't many travellers worth robbing. But I found myself starting nervously at sounds in the wood, and hastening back from routine chores like fetching wood and water, eager for the sight and sound of the Mackenzie men. I also found new reassurance in the sound of their snoring around me at night, and lost whatever self-consciousness I might have had about the discreet writhings that took place under our blankets. I was still somewhat fearful of being alone when, a few days later, the time for the meeting with Horrocks arrived.
"Stay here?" I said in disbelief.
"No, I'm going with you."
"You can't," said Jamie patiently once more. "The bulk of the men will go on to Lag Croom, we Ned, to collect the rents, as expected. Dougal and a few of the others are coming with me to the meeting, in case of any treachery by Horrocks. You can't be seen in the open near Lag Croom, though. Randall's men may be about, and I wouldn't have put it past him to take you by force. And as for the meeting with Horrocks, I've no idea what may happen. No, there's a small copse near the bend of the road. It's thick and grassy, and there's water nearby. You'll be comfortable there till I come back for you."
"No," I said stubbornly. "I'm coming with you." Some sense of pride made me unwilling to tell him that I was frightened of being away from him. But I was willing to tell him that I was frightened for him.
"You said yourself you don't know what will happen with Horrocks," I argued. "I don't want to wait here, wondering all day what's happening to you."
"Let me come with you," I coaxed. "I promise I'll stay out of sight during the meeting. But I don't want to stay here alone, worrying all day."
He sighed impatiently, but didn't argue further. When we reached the copse, though, he leaned over and seized my horse's bridle, forcing me off the road into the grass. He slid off his horse, tying both sets of reins to a bush. Ignoring my vociferous objections, he disappeared into the trees. Stubbornly, I refused to dismount. He couldn't make me stay, I thought. He came down at last to the road. The others had gone on before, but Jamie, mindful of our last experience with deserted glades, wouldn't leave until he had thoroughly searched the copse, quartering methodically through the trees and swishing the tall grass with a stick. Coming back, he untied the horses and swung up into his saddle.
"It's safe," he said. "Ride up well into the thicket, Clare, and hide yourself and the horse. I'll be back for you as soon as our business is done. I cannot tell how long, but surely by sunset."
"No, I'm coming with you."
I couldn't stand the thought of stewing in a forest, not knowing what was happening. I would far rather be in active danger than be left for anxious hours, waiting and wondering, and alone. Jamie curbed his impatience to be gone. He reached over and grasped my shoulder.
"Did you no promise to obey me?" he asked, shaking me gently.
"Yes, but..."
"But only because I had to," I was going to say, but he was already urging my horse's head around toward the thicket.
"It's very dangerous, and I'll not have you there, Clare. I shall be busy, and if it comes to it, I can't fight and protect you at the same time."
Seeing my mutinous look, he dropped his hand to the saddlebag and began rummaging.
"What are you looking for?"
"Rope. If you will not do as I say, I shall tie you to a tree until I come back."
"You wouldn't."
"Aye, I would."
Plainly he meant it. I gave in with bad grace and reluctantly reined in my horse. Jamie leaned to kiss me glancingly on the cheek, already turning to go.
"Take care, Sassenach. You've your duck."
"Good.
I shall come back as soon as I can. Oh, one more thing."
"What's that?" I said sullenly.
"If you leave that copse before I come for you, I'll tan your bare ass with my sword belt. You wouldn't enjoy walking all the way to Bagrennan."
"Remember," he said, pinching my cheek gently, "I dinna make idle threats." He didn't either. I rode slowly toward the grove, looking back to watch him racing away, bent low over the saddle, one with the horse, the ends of his plaid flying behind. It was cool under the trees. The horse and I both exhaled with relief as we entered the shade.
It was one of those rare hot days in Scotland, when the sun blazes out of a bleached muslin sky and the early haze is burnt away by 8 o'clock. The copse was loud with birds. A gang of titmice was foraging in the oak clump to the left, and I could hear what I thought was a thrasher in the near distance. I had always been an enthusiastic amateur birder. If I were marooned here till it suited my overbearing, domineering, pig-headed jackass of a husband to finish risking his stupid neck, I'd use the time to see what I could spot. I hobbled the gelding and turned him loose to graze in the lush grass at the edge of the copse, knowing he wouldn't go far. The grass ceased abruptly a few feet from the trees, smothered by the encroaching heather. It was a glade of mixed conifers and oak saplings, perfect for bird-watching. I wandered through it, still mentally fuming at Jamie, but growing gradually calmer as I listened for the distinctive tsee of a flycatcher and the harsh chatter of the missel thrush. The glade ended quite suddenly on the far side, on the edge of a small precipice. I thrust my way through the saplings, and the sound of birdsong was drowned in rushing water. I stood on the lip of a small burn, a steep, rocky canyon with waterfalls bounding down the jagged walls to splash in the brown and silver pools below. I sat down on the edge of the bank and let my feet dangle over the water, enjoying the sun on my face. A crow shot past overhead, closely pursued by a pair of redstarts. The bulky black body zigzagged through the air, trying to avoid the tiny dive bombers. I smiled, watching the furious small parents chivying the crow to and fro, and wondering whether crows, left to their own devices, really did fly in a straight line. That one, if it kept to a straight path, would head straight for... I stopped dead. I had been so intent on arguing with Jamie that it hadn't until this moment dawned on me that the situation I had been vainly trying to bring about for 2 months had finally occurred. I was alone, and I knew where I was. Looking across the burn, my eyes were dazzled by the morning sun blazing through the red ash trees on the far bank. So that was east. My heart began to beat faster. East was over there. Lag Cruam was directly behind me. Lag Cruam was 4 miles to the north of Fort William. And Fort William was no more than 3 miles due west of the hill of Craig na Dun. So, for the first time since my meeting with Murta, I knew approximately where I was. No more than 7 miles from that bloody hill and its accursed stone circle. 7 miles, perhaps, from home. From Frank. I started back into the copse, but changed my mind. I dared not take the road. This close to Fort William and the several small villages that surrounded it, there was too much risk of meeting someone. And I couldn't take a horse down the precipitous course of the burn. In fact, I had some doubt that it could be managed on foot. The rock walls were sheer in some spots, plunging directly into the foaming water of the stream, with no real footing save the tops of scattered rocks sticking out of the rushing water. But it was by far the most direct path in the direction I wanted, and I didn't dare to take too circuitous a route. I might easily lose my way in the wild growth, or be overtaken by Jamie and Dougal returning. My stomach gave a sudden lurch as I thought of Jamie. God, how could I do it? Leave him without a word of explanation or apology? Disappear without a trace after what he had done for me? With that thought, I finally decided to leave the horse. At least he would think I hadn't left him willingly. He might believe I had been killed by wild beasts. I touched the dagger in my pocket. Or possibly kidnapped by outlaws. And finding no trace of me, eventually he would forget me and wed again. Perhaps the lovely young Leah back at Leoch. Absurdly enough, I found that the thought of Jamie sharing Leah's bed upset me as much as the thought of leaving him. I cursed myself for idiocy, but I couldn't help imagining her sweet round face flushed with ardent longing, and his big hands burying themselves in that moonbeam hair. I unclenched my teeth and resolutely wiped the tears off my cheeks. I hadn't time or energy for senseless reflections. I must go, and now, while I could. It might be the best chance I would get. I hoped that Jamie would forget me. I knew that I would never be able to forget him, but for now I must put him out of my mind, or I wouldn't be able to concentrate on the job at hand, which was tricky enough. Cautiously, I picked my way down the steep bank to the edge of the water. The noise of the rushing stream drowned out the birds in the copse above. The going was rough, but there was at least room to walk by the water's edge here. The bank was muddy and strewn with rocks, but passable. Further down, I saw that I would have to step out actually into the water and make my way precariously from rock to rock, balancing above the flood, until the bank widened enough to go ashore again. I picked my way painfully along, estimating how much time I might have. Jamie had said only that they would return before sundown, 3 or 4 miles to Lag Cruam, but I had no way of knowing what the roads were like, nor how long the business with Horrocks might take. If he was there. But he would be, I argued with myself. Hugh Monroe had said so, and outlandish as that grotesque figure had been, Jamie plainly considered him a reliable source of information. My foot slipped off the first rock in the stream, plunging me into icy water to the knees and soaking my skirt. I withdrew to the bank, tucked my skirts as high as I could, and removed both shoes and stockings. I slipped these into the pocket made by my tucked-up skirt and set my foot again on the rock. I found that by gripping with my toes, I could manage to step from rock to rock without slipping. The bunches of my skirt made it difficult to see where I was going to step next, though, and more than once I found myself sliding into the water. My legs were chilled, and as my feet grew numb, it got harder to maintain my grip. Luckily, the bank widened again, and I stepped gratefully ashore into warm, sticky mud. Short periods of more or less comfortable squelching alternated with much longer periods of precarious rock-hopping through the freezing rapids, and I found, to my relief, that I was much too busy to think very much about Jamie. After a time, I had the routine worked out. Step, grip, pause. Look around. Locate next step. Step, grip, pause, and so on. I must have become overconfident, or perhaps only tired, because I got careless and undershot my goal. My foot skidded helplessly down the near side of the slime-coated rock. I waved my arms wildly, trying to move back to the rock I had been on, but my balance had shifted too far. Skirts, petticoats, dagger and all, I plunged into the water. And kept on plunging. While the stream overall was only a foot or two deep, there were intermittent deep pools where the scouring water had scooped out deep depressions in the rock. The one on which I'd lost my footing was perched on the edge of one such pool, and when I hit the water, I sank like a rock myself. I was so stunned by the shock of the icy water rushing into my nose and mouth that I didn't cry out. Silvery bubbles shot out of the bodice of my dress and rushed past my face toward the surface above. The cotton fabric soaked through almost at once, and the freezing grip of the water paralyzed my breathing. I began almost at once to fight my way up to the surface, but the weight of my garments pulled me down. I yanked frantically at the laces of my bodice, but there was no hope of getting everything off before I drowned. I made a number of savage and uncharitable silent observations about dressmakers, women's fashions, and the stupidity of long skirts, while kicking frenziedly to keep the entangling folds away from my legs. The water was crystal clear. My fingers brushed the rock wall, sliding through the dark, slick streamers of duckweed and algae. Slippery as waterweed, that's what Jamie said about my... The thought jarred me out of my panic. Suddenly I realized that I shouldn't be exhausting myself trying to kick to the surface. The pool couldn't be more than 8 or 9 feet deep. What I needed to do was relax, float down to the bottom, brace my feet and spring upward. With luck, that would get my head clear for a breath, and even if I went down again,
I could continue bouncing off the bottom till I worked my way close enough to the edge to get a decent grip on the rock. The descent was agonizingly slow. As I was no longer fighting upward, my skirts rose round me in billows, floating in front of my face.